It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert's off today. Coming up, a new Gallup poll shows the number of uninsured Americans is on track to be the lowest it's been in years. A health policy expert discusses whether or not this is because of the Affordable Care Act. First, there have been five major extinction events since the birth of life on our planet, wiping out not just a species here and there, but hundreds or even thousands of them. The most recent and most famous was the fifth extinction, 65 million years ago, the event that wiped out the dinosaurs, among others, most likely caused by a collision with an asteroid. Or maybe that's not the most recent extinction event. A growing number of scientists say there's a lot of evidence that we're in the middle of one right now, and it's our fault. Elizabeth Colbert joins us now. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker. Her new book is The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we may have the sense that we're losing a species every now and again, and there are others endangered on the brink. What's the evidence that we're in the midst of an actual mass extinction event?
Well, I think people have this idea, you know, as you say, we are losing this species, we're losing that species, and it doesn't really strike them as anything unusual because we've really become inured to that sort of information. But what happens when you look at the long picture, at the big picture, is we discover that actually, you know, in the course of a human lifetime, you really should not see a single species go extinct. So geologists define something known as the background extinction rate. That's the rate at which you'd expect species to be going extinct sort of in the normal, quote-unquote, normal course of events. And when they compare the rate at which species are going extinct now to that, they see that it is, you know, hundreds, probably thousands of times higher than it has been for most of the history of life.
And the idea in this sixth extinction is this one's on us. This is all, or mostly at least, caused by humans in one way or the other.
Yes, I'm gonna go with all there. I mean, there are it's very, very, very difficult to point to a species that has or is going extinct, you know, in recent history and say that it had no component, of human activity that led to its demise. And the reason for this is simply that we have become really the dominant force on the planet right now. We are changing the world very quickly and very radically. We have replaced the geological forces that in the past caused these events.
We'll get into some of what you learned talking to scientists all over the world about this, but I want to get into the why a little. You write that you're worried about the legacy our species will leave behind when we're gone.
Well, if you really take, once again, the long view, we tend to look at human accomplishments in terms of our arts and our music and our monuments, let's say, cultural achievements. But if you look at what is really going to survive on Earth, it's going to be the record of what we did to other species. That's going to be inscribed, as it were, in the rocks. And whoever or whatever comes along millions of years from now is going to see that some very dramatic event in the history of life happened right now. And that is going to be our legacy. It's going to determine the course of life forever, right? Because if you cut off one evolutionary pathway, that pathway is never followed again. So we are determining, you know, both which pathways are being cut off and at the same time which pathways are going to remain open and repopulate this planet.
The concept of extinction, as humans understand it, is relatively new. When did we first start thinking of the concept that a species could go extinct?
Yeah, that's a really interesting story that I try to recount in the book. And if you go back about, as recently as the late 1700s, people really had no concept of extinction. And this was the case even though, as Europeans came to North America, they encountered a lot of really weird bones that they couldn't explain. For example, mastodon bones were very, very perplexing to the Europeans. And even Thomas Jefferson, who was really a fossil aficionado and kept them at the White House, he thought that when he sent Lewis and Clark to the Northwest, they were going to find live mastodons roaming around, because the general idea was if an animal had been created, you know, it had been created for all time, and it was still out there somewhere. And then a French naturalist named Georges Cuvier came along and really just said, no, that's not the case. If these animals were out there, we would have seen them already. And that was really the first instance of someone someone definitively declaring something extinct, and he went on to sort of posit many, many extinctions and to, in fact, find or at least identify many extinct animals. He named the mastodon, for example. We get that word from him. He named pterodactyls. We get that word from him. So his legacy also lives on in our language.
As we bought the concept of extinction, we started discovering these mass extinction events that you write about. What were some of the causes of those five previous massive die-offs?
Well, that's another very interesting question, and many of them are still, you know, very much under investigation, as it were, because you're looking at cold cases, as it were, that are now hundreds, in some cases, hundreds of millions of years old. So the very first of these, what are called the Big Five mass extinctions of the last half a billion years, occurred about 450 million years ago. And at that point, life was still really confined to the water. So that was a devastating event for marine life, but not for terrestrial life, because there simply was no terrestrial life. And that, it's believed, was caused by a sudden cold snap, planetary cold snap, a glaciation. But no one knows exactly why that glaciation took place. And the most recent one, which you alluded to, the event that did in, you know, not just the dinosaurs, but lots and lots of the world, lots and lots of the major groups of organisms on the world, the pterosaurs and the ammonites and most of the mammals and most of the reptiles. I mean, it was a very devastating event. It's believed to have been caused by an asteroid impact. There's a pretty broad scientific consensus that was the cause.
A newer idea in science, though, is this idea of the sixth extinction that we're in the midst of. When did that idea come about, and how quickly is that concept spreading?
Well, I think the sixth extinction idea, and I personally have been unable to uncover exactly who the first person was to use that phrase, came about pretty much as soon as people realized, and this was not until there's sort of a twisting history to the study of extinction, and it for quite a long time it was believed that these extinction events must have, to the extent that they were events, they happened very slowly, they weren't really events. It was believed that you didn't get sudden change on Earth, and that was a product of a British naturalist named Charles Lyell, who was a mentor to Darwin and really influenced geology for many, many generations, his theories. And then it was not till the 1980s when it was proposed that an asteroid impact was what had done in the dinosaurs and ended the Cretaceous period that people began to rethink this idea of, can the Earth change very quickly? Are there catastrophes in the history of life? And right around that time was when people were starting to look at what are extinction rates today and becoming very alarmed about that. So the notion that catastrophes can happen and that a catastrophe is in fact happening, you know, sort of occurred to people right around the same time, probably in the mid-1980s.
And it's unprecedented. One species apparently driving this new mass extinction. What is it about the way we evolved that made us different from every other species that had come before and made us a risk factor for a mass extinction?
Well, we turn out to be a really unusual phenomenon, and one of the only real unifying characteristics that all of these extinction events seem to share is that they represent moments of rapid global change. And when you think about it, what are people doing right now? We are rapidly changing the whole globe. And the way we're doing that, you know, turns out to be that we're very smart. We have these huge societies. We're very cooperative. And we pass knowledge down from one generation to the other, so we learn a lot, and what we learn, we maintain. And these are all, you know, really, when you think about it, pretty much unique in the animal world. So we have the power to change the world. We've had that for a long, long time, and we have, in fact, probably been causing extinctions for quite a while. You know, when the first Native Americans arrived on this continent, they found a lot of huge animals, mastodons, mammoths, huge ground sloths that are not around. And it's widely believed at this point that hunting probably did in those large animals that had a very low birth rate. So we've been at this for a while, but when you think of how much technology has improved, how much globalization has ratcheted up in the last few generations, you start to see why our impacts are becoming more and more pervasive and more potentially dangerous.
Elizabeth Kolbert is with us. We're talking about her new book, The Sixth Extinction, about the possibility that we're in the midst of a mass extinction event and that our species is driving that event. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts, your solutions. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. We continue our conversation about the sixth extinction, a mass extinction event caused by our species, our guest says. Elizabeth Kolbert is with us. Her new book is The Sixth Extinction. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. We'll get to your calls in just a few moments. First, though, Elizabeth, why will this affect us? All these species are going extinct. Is it going to hurt us? Are we going to be a part of the extinction event we created ourselves?
Well, I rather pointedly avoid answering that question. How's that in the book? Although obviously it's a question that everyone is interested in, and I guess there are two ways to answer it. I mean, first of all, we have driven a lot of species extinct already. We're very good at taking over the niches and habitats of other species, and so far, you know, we've done pretty well doing that. So there are more people on the planet than ever right now. So it's possible that we'll be fine, but it's also possible, you know, one of the paleontologists I quote in the book says that at these moments of mass extinction, the rules of the survival game seem to change, and groups of organisms, you know, like the dinosaurs, who were dominant for quite a long time, far longer than humans have even existed, are suddenly gone. And so when you change the rules of the survival game, you sort of don't know what's going to happen. You could say at that point all bets are off.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Laura in New Berlin. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Rob. Given the indefensible, ignominious harm our species causes, do you think it would be ethical and honorable for us to completely change direction and regard ongoing expansion as unacceptable? In fact, a reduction of, let's say, 90% or more of our numbers is the only ethical course so that we can cohabit in the biosphere.
Elizabeth, what do you think?
Well, a reduction of our numbers of 90% or more is a very, very tall order. I mean, in fact, human population is still increasing pretty at a pretty rapid clip. We're going to, you know, hit 8 billion people probably within the next decade or so, and then population is projected to continue to increase, although at a slower rate over the rest of the century. I'm not sure, you know, that there's any ethical way, unfortunately, to radically reduce our numbers either. So what the ethical, you know, path when we have a lot of people on the planet, and at the same time when we know that we're having, you know, potentially quite devastating impacts on so many other species, you know, what the ethics are of that situation, I'm going to say I just don't know.
Well, but do you think there's an ethical responsibility to try to prevent future extinctions wherever possible?
I certainly think there's an ethical responsibility to try, whether that means, you know, that we have a responsibility. I'm not sure what your caller meant, to be honest, by radically reducing the human population.
Well, setting aside the human population, just conservation efforts, that sort of thing.
Yes, but I think the point of the book really is that we have to look at these ways in which we're changing the planet, you know, that go beyond any kind of spatial or boundary. You know, we're putting a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere. We're changing the climate. We're changing the chemistry of the oceans. We're moving species around the world at a very, very rapid clip. Something like 10,000 species are being moved around the world every day in the ballast water of our ships. So, and that can have quite devastating impact. So we have to look even beyond, you know, sort of what we think of as conserving this piece of habitat or that, if we want to look at the really root causes of what's going on.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Carl with us in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello. There's a saying that nature bats last, and the way in which we dump so much CO2 into the atmosphere may be having an effect on how much methane is being released in the Arctic, because as the Arctic warms and the ice sheets that are covering up all that ancient flora and fauna are dumped into the atmosphere as well. We don't know how close we are to a tipping point in which runaway climate change becomes something that we really have no say or any more control over. And it strikes me that we're such an odd species to have the knowledge and the understanding that this is what we're doing to our planet. And yet, you know, quotes that Wisconsin may have the climate of Arkansas within my children's lifetime, that's not a far-fetched idea. That's mainstream science extrapolated out from where we are now to where we're going if we don't fundamentally change. And yet we don't seem to be able to grab that in a way that politicians or the ways in which we make decisions or really reason over future choices, we seem to be blind or paralyzed by our own destructive capacity.
Thanks for the call, Carl. Elizabeth, what do you have to say about that?
Well, I think Carl makes a really, really, several really, really good points. And E.O. Wilson, you know, who's really one of the most famous biologists out there today, has this phrase, and I'm not going to get it quite right, but he points out that we have minds that are really, you know, prehistoric. We're really basically the same as our Stone Age ancestors, but now we possess these godlike technologies, and that's not necessarily a happy combination, but it just is the way it is. And so our ability to invent various technologies, which we then cannot control the effects of, you know, maybe that's surprising, but on some ways maybe it's not surprising. There's no given that just because we can invent it, we can use it properly.
Carl, thanks a lot for the call. Another concept that's risen, I think, around the same time as the sixth extinction is the idea that we're in a new geological era, the Anthropocene era. Can you talk about what that is, what that means?
Yes, I mean, that's very intimately related to this idea that we are changing the planet on a geological scale. So geologists, you know, divide time into these various epochs and periods and eras, the big system, and they look at these times where there seem to have been changes for whatever reason. Sometimes it's hard to identify why, either changes in the fauna, so changes in the fossil record, or changes in the topography, you know, sort of the Earth. And when they think about sort of projecting into the future, okay, what is this moment in time going to look like in the geological record? They say, well, this is going to look at, you know, as dramatic as many of the major episodes in Earth history, so potentially as dramatic as that asteroid impact that ended the Cretaceous and that, you know, wiped out so many species. It will seem slow to us because we're in the middle of it, but when it's compressed down to a tiny layer of sediment, it's going to look very, very fast, very much, you know, like an impact.
I wanted to bring up that idea of timescale that you just touched on. An event happening over the course of 20,000 years is a very short period of time for a geologist, say, a very long time, obviously, for a human. How can we recalibrate our thinking to grasp a concept that we're in the midst of this thousands of year long mass extinction?
Yeah, that's really one of the things I try to do in the book, is give people a really, you know, long perspective on life and lift us a little bit out of our day-to-day, where people may say, well, look, I don't see any change going on, right? Because we do all live in one small place and have one small experience. And so to try to help people and spur people to think about things in a longer range, in a bigger picture sort of way. And when you do that, as you suggest, you have to really completely try, and it's very, very, you know, tough, and obviously we can only partially succeed at this, to think of time in a different way, you know, how long life has been here and how long hopefully it will be here, and to see our moment here as really just a small part of this story. And in fact, humans, you know, modern humans have only been around for about 200,000 years, and life has been around for about 3.5 billion years. So you see how very, very recent we are on the face of the Earth.
Elizabeth, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That was Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer for The New Yorker. Her new book is The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard is off today. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the Paralympics Games are going on this week in Sochi, Russia. We'll meet a Wisconsin man who's working on cross-country skiing for people with disabilities. But first, a new Gallup poll shows the rate of uninsured Americans is on track to be at the lowest level in years. The survey shows the number of uninsured people has dropped in almost every demographic group so far this year. The rate has dropped the most for people who are uninsured and make less than $36,000 a year. Tom Oliver is with us to discuss this news and whether or not it can be chalked up to the Affordable Care Act. He's a professor of population health sciences at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and director of the Master of Public Health program at UW-Madison. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
So according to this poll, more people are signing up for health care as more parts of the Affordable Care Act come into practice now. Is there a connection? Did the Affordable Care Act lead more people to be insured?
I think the Affordable Care Act is part of the good news here. Clearly, the economy has been on a slower than desired, but still positive direction for the last few years, and that certainly has brought more people opportunities to have jobs and either pay for their own health benefits or get them through their employment. But there's no question that the news of just in the last month that there's been an uptick in enrollment is almost certainly directly attributable to expansion of Medicaid eligibility in state programs and also folks being able to sign up through the health insurance exchanges, both in the states and those sponsored by the federal government.
So looking at that Gallup poll anyway, still over 15% of Americans are uninsured. Sounds like a lot. Did we expect more people to have coverage by now?
We're expecting, according to the Congressional Budget Office, the nonpartisan so-called scorekeeper of health reform, to see about 7 million people sign up in the first year of the Affordable Care Act's full implementation, which is this year. And so we're well on our way to that, but still about 4 million folks have signed up for health insurance coverage that didn't have it. So we still have a little bit of a gap, and that's probably due to a combination of things. The fiasco around the startup of the federal government health insurance exchanges, healthcare.gov website that we heard much about in the late fall, and also some confusion, and also the fact that you're not required to sign up for insurance until the end of this month, March, before any financial penalties would kick in.
We've seen, in addition to that rocky start of the website, bumping back the deadlines for different groups of employers to have to provide coverage. Is that a sign of poor planning or just a bigger problem that planners thought they had to tackle from the outset?
It's a good question, exactly what the reasons for these delays. They're certainly, some of them are being attributable to politics and electioneering. On the other hand, I think we've seen that this is such a complicated reform that when you're trying to expand private insurance and public insurance options at the same time in different parts of the market and set different rules for each part of that market, that you're not getting it all right at the same time. And so I think some of them are just simply being realistic and wanting to be sure that people don't experience gaps in coverage simply because they or their employers were caught in between, good opportunities to keep their coverage or get new and better improved coverage.
And also on the theme of extensions, the administration announced last week it would allow health insurers to renew plans that aren't currently compliant with the Affordable Care Act for another 2 years to avoid a whole bunch of people dropping off of policies at once, I guess. Was that a good call, or would we have seen this big rush of people without coverage?
it's hard to know what would have happened, and I think I would actually give a little bit of credence to critics who are saying that the administration is picking and choosing different provisions of the legislation in terms of enforcing its implementation. What is not good policy to give people a chance to stay on coverage that has very, very thin benefits, nothing like the coverage that they would be given through the exchanges or other options. So people who keep those plans will not have great coverage typically, or will be liable for very, very large contributions towards that coverage. On the other hand, it avoids a lot of people being confused or not being quite aware where to look for those better options. So I think the problem is that we haven't had as strong an opportunity to get out the message about opportunities for enrollment, had a great outreach, as we saw many years ago with the Children's Health Insurance Program. And so it's been a little bit of a struggle, and the message that the public is receiving is a little bit complex and confusing.
Well, speaking of outreach, here's a clip of President Obama on Zach Galifianakis's sort of semi-serious talk show, Between Two Ferns. The president was there to put in a plug for the health care plan.
What we want is for people to know that you can get affordable health care. And most young Americans right now, they're not covered. And the truth is that they can get coverage all for what it costs you to pay your cell phone bill.
So there's the president in a venue reaching out to younger Americans with a message targeted toward younger people. How important is that to the success of the Affordable Care Act, getting younger people to sign up?
Well, it's really important from the sheer perspective of we want a broad risk pool, so to speak. We need young people and healthier people in the pool because that both lowers the average costs of health insurance, but it also gives insurance companies a chance to lower what we call the risk premium that's added on top, the uncertainty that they have that they might have to pay out more in healthcare costs than the premiums coming in the door. And so we all benefit with lower healthcare costs, the more of us that are in the insurance pool. The thing is, we've had dramatic success with many parts of the Affordable Care Act. Remember, the full name of it was the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. And the patient protections are the things that are by far the most popular with Americans. You don't have lifetime limits to your insurance coverage. You can't be kicked off because you got sick and cost the insurance company a lot of money. You can't be kicked out because somebody found an error in your application, including a typo or something that allows them to invalidate it. And for young people, the key provision was that you could stay on your family's health coverage if that was desirable in terms of cost or the quality of coverage. And so millions of young Americans have been able to either gain or maintain their coverage through that key provision of the Affordable Care Act.
We've seen some analysis that Wisconsin, as far as people who have signed up for the Affordable Care Act goes, is among the oldest in the country. Us, and I think it was West Virginia, had an older population signing up, not as many young people. Is that a worry on a state-by-state basis?
I think it depends on how we see things playing out over the next year or two. We've had a slower rollout of the Affordable Care Act provisions because Wisconsin did not expand its own Medicaid program to the fullest extent possible under the law, and it is a little slow in getting its health insurance exchange up and running compared to some of the other states that actually launched well ahead of the formal deadline this winter. So I think we're going to have to see how that plays out. But it wouldn't necessarily be that surprising given the large number of manufacturing jobs that were lost in the Great Recession and have not been reclaimed. Those tended to come with good insurance and good salaries or wages that would allow people to buy coverage. So we may be seeing a lagged effect of our overall economic performance in the health insurance enrollment number so far.
Looking ahead, are we going to see something close to full coverage in our country?
Actually, and that's probably the single most misleading part of the Affordable Care Act, as people understand it. It was not designed to actually give us universal coverage. We were always going to have, even in the best scenario, about 20 to 30 million people still uninsured. On the other hand, about 30 million or more were going to gain insurance coverage. So it's a half a loaf approach, but it's a huge step forward, and it really sets up the opportunity to keep expanding towards universal coverage. If our economy improves, if our the politics around healthcare reform settle down, and we get back to the question of what do people really need, and what are we willing to do as a country to ensure that there's adequate health care, and we learn that as we see the numbers roll out, that paying now is better than paying later for an awful lot of health care problems. And I would say, Rob, the good news, the really good news of the Affordable Care Act and health care reform in general, is that we've had by far the greatest slowdown in health care spending in a generation or two. Over the last 30 years, we had annual increases of about 7% or more in our nation's health care bill. The last 4 years, we've had 3% to 3.5%.
We'll leave it there. Tom, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
That's Tom Oliver, professor of population health sciences at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, talking about a new poll showing the rate of uninsured Americans is on track to be the lowest it's been in years. The Winter Olympics were in Sochi, Russia earlier this year. Now another important Olympics event is going on this week, the 2014 Paralympics. To update us on the Paralympics, they started on March 7th, running through the 16th. We have Yuri Gusev. He's athletic director for the Central Cross Country Ski Association in Verona. Yuri got involved with adaptive cross-country skiing 10 years ago. Since then, he's introduced over 1,000 people with physical disabilities and visual impairment to Nordic skiing, a big Wisconsin tradition. He's also helped train 4 American athletes currently taking part in those games in Sochi. Yuri, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much having us at the show.
Well, I bet you're watching the games closely. Can you give an update on how American athletes are doing there?
I think they're doing pretty well and had some close performances to the medal, and we had the first female silver medal for the United States. So I think it's pretty exciting for the team and for everyone.
Well, I use the phrase adaptive cross-country skiing. What is that?
Adaptive cross-country skiing, that's cross-country skiing for individuals with physical disabilities and visual impairment or blindness. So it covers, all pretty much ranges.
And how do you train people to do that? What's the training process like for somebody, say, with physical disabilities or visual impairments to get started?
It's actually pretty similar to able-bodied individuals. Obviously, depends on the disability. They have equipment would be different in some cases. In some cases, it will be exactly the same. So the first step typically is to find out what type of equipment, adaptable type of equipment we need to use so someone can participate.
So someone doesn't have arms or legs. How do you make the equipment work for that person?
For example, if someone missing both legs, in that case, we would use a sit ski. It's a chair that get clamped to the skis, and they'll propel. The skier will propel with the poles, just like normal cross country skiing. If someone missing an arm or both arms or part of the arm, so they will use exactly the same skis, and they will ski with one pole. Sometimes, if it's, for example, below knee amputee, for example, we had an athlete, Dan Perkins, So he was just using the part of prosthetic leg, and he was using just the same equipment, skis and poles. And for visual impaired or blind athletes, the same. It's the same equipment, skis and poles. They just need to ski with the guide.
With that specialized equipment, this isn't something I imagine you can just pop into a store and buy. Is it being specially built for people?
Definitely. When we have to, if a skier needs to use a sit ski, yes, it's a special equipment, a chair, again, built based on someone's disability. And, for example, we developed, with the help of partners, we developed equipment that is adjustable based on disability. So this way we virtually can use it for really for individuals with any physical disabilities. We can fit them in that chair.
And I understand in the past you've kind of had to make something for each individual to fit them, but you're working with some UW engineers to get adaptable frames. Is that right?
Yes. When we just started with the program and we purchased the first sit ski, we learned quickly that it was built custom for someone. So for us, the big question was, how can we take that piece of equipment and use it for anyone with different disabilities? And at that time, we got involved with the engineering department in UW Madison and worked with students to develop a sit ski that actually has adjustable pieces to it, so we can actually fit them based on someone's disability.
Now, you've worked with hundreds of people there on cross-country skiing, and I imagine a lot of them with various disabilities wouldn't have thought they'd ever be able to do something like cross-country skiing. What's the response once they get out there and they hit the trails and they're actually out there skiing?
Oh, they love it. And a lot of people we see that maybe they got injured later or had an injury, and they never knew that there's even possible to cross-country ski if they, for example, had an accident. And once they get on snow on the skis, it's a pretty incredible feeling. And, you know, just like feeling, you know, skiing for the first time and feeling you have on sliding on snow for the first time, it's a pretty incredible feeling. And for people that learn that there is, again, opportunity for them to ski with a family or with friends by themselves and go outdoor and enjoy outdoor and do recreation, people definitely have very incredible experiences.
And then how common is it for someone to start off doing this for fun, recreation, exercise, and then decide, hey, I want to go to the next level and compete?
There are people that have motivation to compete, and they want to do the best they can. From our standpoint, first, we want to introduce them to the sport and have them enjoy it. And if they decide that they want to do something more, even just competing at the local events, we have many individuals going to American Birkebeiner, and there are some other events around the state and in Midwest that provide opportunity to participate and compete in their events if they're adaptive skiers. So a lot of people just go and participate in the citizen-level events, and if there are any that are interested to compete at the higher level, we definitely have resources for them do that.
And Yuri, I hear you've got a sneak preview for us. There's going to be an announcement in a couple days at the Sochi Paralympics about Wisconsin. Can you share the news with us?
Yes, yeah, so it's very exciting. It will be a very exciting event for us at that level. It's World Championships is just a step below from Paralympic Games, so we'll see the best athletes from around the world. And again, announcement will be in a couple of days made in Sochi. And I hope we can have people to come and watch and cheer for Team USA and for U.S. athletes.
And that the Paralympic World Championships you mentioned are going to be here in Wisconsin?
In Cable, Wisconsin, correct.
Cable, Wisconsin. And you played a role in helping make that happen, I gather.
Yeah. We hosted two World Cup events first. That was our first step in 2012 and 2013. And all the countries loved northern Wisconsin and the communities up up north, and we got awarded to host the World Championships.
How exciting is that for you, being someone who's really put our state on the map in adaptive cross-country skiing?
Well, it's definitely very, very rewarding event to have, and there will be a lot of people involved to make sure it goes well, and we're all very excited to produce the best event we can for the athletes to showcase Wisconsin, and especially northern Wisconsin.
And just briefly, people can get involved as participants in adaptive cross-country skiing or volunteers. What's the best way to get in touch with you?
The best way probably would be to go to Cable Chamber of Commerce website, and as soon as the announcement is made, we'll have links to the event and volunteer sign up and schedule of the events so people can come and observe and spectate the events on the Chamber of Commerce website and Cable.
Yuri, thank you so much for joining us today. That was Yuri Gusev, Athletic Director for Central Cross Country Ski Association in Verona, talking about adaptive cross-country skiing and the Paralympics.